This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The Lake County Council holds more meetings this afternoon with their department heads on their 2020 budget proposals. It's all part of the procedure that leads to finalized budgets later this year. County Council President Ted Bilski talked about that process this morning and how well prepared he thinks they are for the next budget year, which he says may or may not be a tight one. I'll ask you first here, if you'll bring us up to date on what work you and the other members of the Lake County Council have done up to this point on taking a look at what the 2020 Lake County Government Department budgets are going to look like.
Chris, at the beginning of summer, the council members started meeting with each division within Lake County Government, mm-hmm. each elected officials reviewing, and as they submitted their budgets, had committee meetings to look at the projected increases. As preparing for what the certified tax levy will be, that won't happen until 2020. But as we sat and met with each elected officials, and respectively, we had a presentation day. We also went through first session, and we prioritized, put into the budget what we thought was a reasonable raise. This afternoon, we'll finish up the rest of those requests. Mm-hmm. It'll give us a true idea by at 1 o'clock meeting today. On exactly where we are to a bottom line and close to being budget, balance, rather.
Now, I know there are a lot of items that are brought up by each particular department. Some of the things that are routine things, you know, just continuing on certain operations or purchases and the like. Are there any in particular that you can recall that stand out in your mind that are up for review in this upcoming budget cycle?
Two-part, to answer that in twofold, you're right. What we did approve is a lot of state-mandated raises. The state has mandated raises. There's raises per collective bargaining agreements that were approved and in there. So some of the capital expenditures that come out that we're looking at to finance, maybe through public safety, would be in the sheriff's department, the courts. But one of the most, the biggest ones would be in the prosecutor's office, who is needing large increases in order to stay competitive to get good attorneys to work in the prosecutor's office.
Sounds like some of these are kind of like routine matters that come up, at least in particular when you have the county prosecutor coming forward and say, hey, I need to add more staff because of more cases to handle and things like that come up. And then you say you have the issue of having to compete with, in this case, the rest of the Bar Association, I guess, right?
Well, absolutely. Porter County, it's no different. Everybody, we're not the highest paid in the area by far. We're probably on the low spectrum throughout the 92 counties in the state of Indiana. So we have to look at a way of retaining good professionals, so we're going to have to figure out. We tried to meet them about halfway so far. We'll see where we're at. I'm sure Mr. Carter will be up there at 1 o'clock and coming to see us to see if mm-hmm. he can get more money, I'm sure.
Are there any particular efforts that you and your fellow council members have to make when you take a look at all of these departmental requests and talk with the department heads? And, of course, you end up making the final decision later at an open council meeting. But are there any things in particular that you have to keep an eye on, like the percentage of increases? You mentioned you've been able to kind of keep an eye on the costs of government. Or is that kind of follow all the way through, all the way to wages, if need be?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, each department head, each elected official really has to zero out, look at their budget, see what they need. Obviously there's some things that are going to go up for outlying units, rent, utility. Those are all increases no different than you face in your household income. Other departments are going to have increases in major line items. For example, the cost of salt. We don't know what that market's going to bring, what that cost is going to be for that salt for the highway department. So fuel cost. So there's some variables. There's ones that always show increase. But we have to ask them to really zero out their budgets, look within their own means, help us save on these other line items so that folks can get at least some type of cost of living increase.
Do you think also, too, that you just have to ask the department heads to take a look at what they've been asking for and just kind of keep in mind the fact that we were going to do all right, but, it's going to be tight, and you just can't go hog wild, so to speak, and ask for something?
Absolutely. We're looking at it. The full impact of the tax caps, will be felt over the year. We'll see where we're at. 2021 might be a more crucial year when it comes to it. But I think the county is prepared. We've been fiscally responsible. The budget has been balanced. We've not lived with beyond our means. So I am hopeful that those issues won't be there for us as county government. You know, a lot of things have impacted communities and tax collections. We talk about the big box, or you refer to the black box, you know, the South Lake Mall. The town of Merrillville, for example, lost a lot of assessed value, which is revenue for that town to provide police, fire, I mean, crucial services. So when Merrillville lost the Radisson, the Holiday Star, the towers, that was an impact to their tax collection, as well as the tax appeal that's in process with South Lake Mall. They have a legislation passed that does not tax them at market value as you and I would be on our home. So for an example, if the mall sold for, you know, approximately $280 million, they were assessed around $160. They would look for a reduction through this as an empty store of around $90 million assessment and then tax accordingly. So that's an impact to communities that they're going to lose money that way, revenue, tax revenue. And this is tax revenue that goes directly to, like I said, not only your schools, which is 60% of the property tax bill, but yeah, approximately, and then, you know, public safety, which, you know, you can't put a dollar figure on it. Yeah.
So it looks like that really the individual communities and the school districts within the communities or nearby are going to be the ones that are likely to be the most affected by losing the tax caps in 2020. That Lake County government's tried to do their best to kind of keep an eye on the expenses so that it won't have maybe not as much impact, unless, you as you say, maybe things may have to be a little bit tighter in 2021.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think we've proven working under a frozen levy. We reduced by over $20 million. We reduced staffing. So that was a huge cost savings, and we've been pretty consistent in there. We've had to, of course, you know, and anyone that's been aware of what's been going on in the jail under the decree, we're getting out of that. Yeah. We've had to hire correctional officers. It's funny the way the conversation just went, because one of the things about the correctional officers is, you know, we have increased those wages, and they are looking for professional correctional officers. They're needed. But, you know, the economy is doing fairly well right now, and I venture it is doing well. So when it is doing well, those types of jobs, even though they pay a decent wage, are hard to fill. So we do have shortcomings in, you know, finding folks for those types of positions.
Now, I would imagine, even though this is a matter that comes up before the county commissioners, since they're kind of in charge, but you guys hold the purse strings when it comes to things like the budgets and, of course, and the impact that it has. Do you think that with the way that the sheriff's department wants to take the budget for 2020, that the decree may finish up and the jail may be out from underneath all that if things go well?
Yes, you are correct. In Lake County, Indiana, the county council is the legislative and fiscal body. No. The commissioners are the executive body of government. So those decisions, contracts, all that are all signed by the commissioners. And we have a great relationship working with them, and we have had over the years. Where I see other counties having nightmares, we've been really good working together as a team.
That's good to hear.
So and we have our ups and downs, don't get me wrong, mm-hmm. like anything else, like any other relationship, there's ups and downs, but at the end of the day, we do what's best for the taxpayers in Indiana, and I'm proud of that, regardless of political affiliation. But back to your question mm-hmm. on those issues about, you know, splitting the budget, putting in those increases, that's one of the things about the public safety revenue. Sheriff Oscar Martinez has been doing a stellar job. I think he's been a really great sheriff. He's been very conservative, fiscally responsible, I should say, and putting the right people in charge. So the manpower request, we're trying to fill them. We've tried to give back responsibilities and delegate to the sheriffs, which by state law should be in the sheriff's hands. And so, like I said, working together and the elected officials working together and realizing where we are financially and to deliver the best benefits for the taxpayers of Lake County.
All right, Tab, take us through the day today. As you mentioned, you have more meetings with the county council together and talking with department heads. And what is the timetable going to be now? You're going through today and then the going ahead for actual final official review and passage of the budget.
Yes, well, first off, today is our regular council meeting, and then following at 1 p.m. is the first budget meeting, our second budget meeting, and I believe we'll have some changes, entry. The financial advisors will give us a 15-line statement letting us know where we are at financially, where we're projected revenues, and hopefully by the end of today, we will pass and be ready for tomorrow's, would be balanced and ready for our first reading tomorrow.
Now, when's the final adoption of the budget supposed to happen? I know you have, there's certain restrictions that you have to follow.
We're not until October. You have to advertise way in advance. So there's more budget, the advertised budget, there's more than enough days. You know, I'd rather have more days we can cancel at a meeting than not have enough days to get the budget done. So going into this, and when this had to be advertised in the first meeting in August, we put in more than what we thought was enough days to meet and work on any issues we might have.
Well, Ted, thank you for spending time with us to talk about this, bringing us through the process, how the budget review process is going for the Lake County government here in 2020. And we'll watch and see how the things finally shape up and before you get to turn the budget over, passed and sent on to Indianapolis for their review. And we appreciate you spending some time with us today to talk about it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Lake County Council President Ted Bilski. Nationwide, e-cigarette use rose an alarming 78% among high school students last year. The FDA has warned manufacturers to stop marketing to kids by using fruity flavors and colorful packages, but that hasn't stopped the surge, even in rural areas where the access to stores is limited. Lita Noon talks from a school in Newton County.
North Newton Junior Senior High lies in the northwest corner of Indiana, in a county home to more dairy cows than people. But students have no problem getting e-cigarettes in all shapes and sizes. Some look like pens, others like computer thumb drives.
Probably most people my age, if you're not a smoker or none of that, it could be sitting right in front of you and you wouldn't even know what it was.
That's teacher Bob Gonzi, who took an informal poll of PE students. Junior high kids estimate 65% of their classmates are using vape devices, and high school students think their numbers are even higher. Assistant Principal Jerry Taylor dumps a bag full of confiscated materials onto a desk. There are vape pens, a bottle of marshmallow-flavored e-liquid, an electronic charger, and the highly popular Juul brand devices.
There's been 34 vaping episodes, and we put kids out 3 days.
Taylor explains that without a specific vape policy, they're following the 3-day suspensions of the smoking policy. Because e-cigarettes are so easy to hide, they're very disruptive in classrooms. Health teacher Josh Stringfellow says students blow smoke rings while the teacher is turned away.
They'll film it on Snapchat, send it around the school because, hey, I got away with it in so-and-so's class. I did this trick in this teacher's classroom. And now they're one-upping each other. And that's why they're being caught more easily, is because they're being so blatant about it.
A senior from nearby Lowell High School, Kate Holdeman, says vaping became the hot thing after winter break last year.
It's pretty crazy. It's definitely an epidemic. I mean, for a long time, you like couldn't walk into a restroom without like vapor just being in your face because everybody at some point did it.
Holdeman says he doesn't use e-cigarettes, but his friends do, and his mom, Stacy Stewart, says that's worrisome.
My smart kid over here started hanging out with some not smart kids who did stuff like that, and I mean, it was in his car a lot, and we had a blow up about it. I mean, it's better now, but it's just scary because there's so many health things that kids just don't realize.
And those health consequences are real. Newton County Public Health Nurse Kim Durham says the problem, nicotine.
What we're really still looking at, once again, are people having a nicotine addiction. This is the kind of stuff that leads to heart disease, that leads to cardiovascular problems, that can lead to pulmonary problems. There's all kinds of different things that can go into play here.
She spoke to 6th and 8th graders at school health fairs.
I was actually mostly surprised because we asked them where they started doing it, and a lot of them said, well, my parents do it. And some of them had, that's kind of how they ended up getting introduced to it, was mom and dad.
Durham says there's a misconception e-cigarettes are safe because some people use them to stop smoking. But she says nicotine levels can be much higher in e-cigarettes. North Newton administrators want to curb the use of e-cigarettes next year. Taylor says they're considering having the local police get involved.
Start ticketing these kids if it's $150 or whatever. And maybe that would curtail them buying these vapes and bringing them into school.
Gonzi agrees that that will make a difference.
You know, we find out here, hold the parents responsible. You get in their pocketbook a little bit, they'll curb behaviors, especially for their children.
For next fall, Gonzi and Taylor are working toward a school e-cigarette policy. They also want to develop information for the curriculum and for parents. Meanwhile, they'll get some help from the FDA. New ads about the dangers of e-cigarettes are scheduled to hit the airwaves this summer. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Lee Dinoon.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. On this edition of Building Northwest Indiana, Kevin Comerford talks with Sherry Ziller about transit development districts.
Welcome to this episode of Building Northwest Indiana Radio. My name is Kevin Comerford. I'm the Director of Professional Development at the Construction Advancement Foundation of Northwest Indiana. I will be serving as your host today. The purpose of Building Northwest Indiana Radio is to give you a little insight into the Northwest Indiana professional construction industry. Today, we're going to be talking about transit development districts, also known as TDDs. These districts are basically an innovative plan to finance development near commuter rail stations on the South Shoreline and proposed West Lake Extension. My guest today is going to be Sherry Ziller. Sherry is the Chief Operating Officer for the Regional Development Authority. Thank you for joining us, Sherry. How are you today?
Oh, I'm doing just fine. How are you doing, Kevin?
Oh, I am well. I just want to kind of get into a lot of our viewers or a lot of our listeners. Let me go back because there's no viewers. A lot of our listeners aren't really familiar with the RDA, I wouldn't think. Can you tell us a little bit about your organization and what you do and your role there?
Sure, Kevin. Absolutely. Thank you for having me on and the opportunity to speak today about the RDA and the transit development districts. So the RDA, we've been around for a while now, a little over a decade, and we're a catalyst to transform the economy and quality of life in Northwest Indiana. The RDA has built a solid foundation. We're known for our catalytic project investments and our strong financial management practices. And together with our partners, we're changing Northwest Indiana's vision for itself and moving the region towards its economic development potential. So as far as the projects that we work on, I would say over the past year, the RDA has focused its energies primarily on the commuter rail expansion, with its partners in pursuit of obtaining the federal matching funds necessary to build the Westlake Corridor extension, and then the double track project to fully double track the existing line from Gary to Michigan City. So we partner with agencies such as NCTE, which is the rail operator, the Indiana Finances Authority, the State Budget Agency, and of course the Federal Transit Administration, the FTA, our federal partners, and of course our communities across the four counties to accomplish these goals. So now I would say what the RDA has been focusing on mostly is developing the transit development districts, like you talked about earlier, around our stations to maximize the development potential around the station areas in our South Shore communities. And we look forward to continuing to invest, as we have been the first decade in Northwest Indiana, to continue those investments in 2019 and beyond. And our vision remains unchanged, Kevin. It's to make Northwest Indiana the leading area for economic growth in Indiana and an example of what Hoosiers can be or do when they're given the global opportunity.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about these transit development districts. I think this all kind of came about in 2017 when the Indiana General Assembly passed, I believe it was House Bill 1144, which was sponsored by State Representative Hal Slager out of Schererville. It puts the Northwest Indiana Regional Development Authority in charge of promoting and managing commercial and residential investment at the transit development district centered at the rail stops. Can you tell us exactly how these transit-oriented development districts work? How is the funding kept in these districts, and what are these districts going to look like for somebody who might be visiting them?
Absolutely. So that's correct. With Representative Hal Slager, he was the one of the main authors behind House Enrolled Act 1144. So yeah, the General Indiana General Assembly back in 2017-2018 placed a new tool in the RDA's toolkit. So it's the Transit Development Districts, or we do call them the TDDs. The intent of the TDDs is to leverage new development around the South Shore stations to fund further improvement at these locations. So basically, it's to promote the private investment. Incremental revenue is generated within the TDD boundary from income tax and property tax, and that can be used for the TOD investments in the district in which they were collected. So if we collected any of the increment from, say, Hammond, we would then reinvest it back into Hammond.
And that's 100%?
Yeah, 100%. So we wouldn't be, you know, we wouldn't take any of that increment and use it in another one of the communities. So it's whatever that community generates, it gets reinvested back in. So then the TOD, the TDD boundary, it can be 1/2 square mile initially. So what House Enrolled Act 1144, like you mentioned before, what it does is it puts the RDA in charge of promoting and managing the commercial and residential investments within the TDD centered around, at least at this point, 11 rail stops. So part of the process is we're going to hold public meetings in each of our communities on the boundaries of the districts, and we want to receive the feedback from the public so we can build that into our thinking. And then eventually we'll be downstate in Indianapolis seeking approval from the State Budget Committee on the boundaries themselves. And our team includes, we have policy analytics. They'll conduct the economic impact of the TDDs, and they'll also do the return on investment analysis. We work with MKSK. They're urban designers. They're going to help us with the community engagement and then the zoning recommendations. And then KPMG out of Chicago. They do the market analysis, the market accelerator. And what they do is really important, too, because they connect us to the development world. So they connect us directly with the developers. So I would say the RDA has begun the process of forming an advisory committee. So we have a steering committee. It's drawn from the communities with the stations. And we look forward to being their partners in their growth. The community was established to advise the RDA as to the local preferences in each of our communities regarding the developments. And they kind of act as an intermediary between the RDA and then the local communities. And we meet quarterly. We've had quite a few meetings already. So right now where we're at in the process, we're meeting with each of those communities to gain a better understanding of their current projects that they have and which ones are in the pipeline and which ones would positively affect the boundary so we can have the best shot at drawing the boundary correctly the first time. So it's really a collaborative effort with the RDA and the communities that it serves. And our goal here is to map the areas we believe can best leverage the state-created financial tools to support the development around the current and planned commuter rail stations.
That'll do it for today's edition of Building Northwest Indiana Radio. I'm your host, Kevin Comerford. Thanks for joining us today.
Kevin was talking with Sherry Ziller, who's the Chief Operating Officer for the Northwest Indiana Regional Development Authority. Support for Building Northwest Indiana comes from the Construction Advancement Foundation. And you can hear Building Northwest Indiana right here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, every Tuesday. And the podcasts are also available online at lakeshorepublicradio.org. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
It used to be that people could either walk to the downtown Gary or take a bus, and the car was not as prevalent as it became later on. But now it's a car to the doctor, it's a car to the shopping mall. It's a car to an auto repair shop, and the use of the car, I think, has dramatically changed the way people live. A lot of residents then and even now are living lives that are totally alien to what they once were. I was raised in the house right across the street from St. John's Church, and then my parents moved to a few blocks from there to another place in the Tolleson area. And from there, they moved to a place in the Horace Mann District. But the Horace Mann District seemed to be changing more rapidly than Tolleson. They were hearing all kinds of news about fights and violence, and they just got a little scared and then moved to Merrillville. I know it was a half better part of the years in Maryville. There was a black family living next door. My parents were fine with that. They didn't have any problem, but they didn't really communicate or really socialize with that family. We'd say hi over the fence and ask how things are going, but we would not invite each other to a social event, you know, like a marriage or a birthday party. That was just not something we would do. Some of these same people from St. John's would move into that subdivision, and they would celebrate events with those families. But in terms of actually visiting, you know, the neighbor next door, that wasn't done. The community was more outside of Maryville. It was at the church, still at the church. It was still at the school for the kids. And I'm seeing that still today. A lot of people just don't have the neighborhood relationship that was once there 40, 50 years ago.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. Interested in getting an MBA? Well, you can get one if you attend classes for the weekend classes program that's coming up again at Indiana University Northwest and the Gary campus. And with us to talk about the weekend MBA program for professionals, we have Professor Micah Pollack with the department's with the School of Business and Economics. And also with us, we have assistant professors Matthew Ludi and Rissio Payne. Thank you all for joining us on the program today.
Thanks for having us, Chris.
Let's start out here a little bit about what the, I guess for somebody who's not familiar with this type of program, they know, of course, know about the regular programs that IU Northwest offers and the MBA program that is often offered, of course, on the main campus in Bloomington. Tell us what the weekend MBA program for professionals is like at IU Northwest.
Thanks, Chris. Well, so it's an 18-month program, and it includes all built-in breaks during the fall and the spring, as well as a longer winter break and a summer break. Classes meet every other Saturday in a cohort model, which emphasizes communal learning. So you have the opportunity to form professional and personal relationships with like-minded peers that will extend far beyond the duration of the program.
This is something that's not an unusual in a lot of campuses. I know they have the cohort concept. How does this fit in well with what's being offered with the MBA program at IU Northwest?
Well, our MBA program focuses on blending teamwork and leadership together. Mm-hmm. So we've decided that those are two aspects that we really want to emphasize. And so throughout the program, those are a focus that we, you know, will continue working on. And when our students graduate, they're very strong in both teamwork and leadership, as well as all the other core business fundamentals that, you know, go along with that.
What kind of advantage do students who go through the program, get their MBA this way, might have compared to going and getting an MBA from some other university?
Well, we're ACSB accredited, which is a very tough accreditation process that ensures that our academic requirements are kept very high and everything is, you know, the latest and the greatest, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But we also have a lot of great bonuses, like you have the opportunity to do a Lean Six Sigma Green Belt certification, a Microsoft Office Specialist certification. We also have in the weekend trip an international business trip. So our most recent MBA program actually just went to Finland, I believe, in the spring.
Wow.
And so you get an opportunity to go in overseas and see how businesses are run elsewhere in the world, maybe in a similar industry or related industry. And so there's a lot of extra bonuses that we get through our the students, I think, really like a lot.
That's great. I understand, Professor Payne, that you've gone through some of these overseas visits.
Yes, we did go on the Finland and Estonia trip. And some of the biggest draws to our program, obviously, is this international experience. During that, it's not just a cultural experience, but we're also able to meet with business executives from companies in energy and transportation, manufacturing, and business. And we actually also had the pleasure of meeting with the senior commercial officer of the U.S. Embassy in Finland.
Wow.
During that, we also got to tour research facilities and visit incubators and innovation centers in Estonia. So there's a lot of great opportunities to actually put into practice, you know, the Lean Six Sigma to see what manufacturers are doing or to learn more about different accounting practices in foreign countries. So it's a great experience for them.
Okay. Now, Professor Ludi, tell us a little bit about how you fit in with the weekend MBA program.
No, I'm teaching in the weekend MBA program in the spring, and it will be a continuation of the financial management weeknight class that I'm teaching now. The weekend class in the spring will pick up where this class leaves off. But my primary role and focus is on teaching the finance courses.
Do you find that since that's such an integral part of getting an MBA that that maybe the students are maybe better prepared for this than maybe some of the academic work that the economic side offers?
I know with the cohort for the MBA students, a lot of the students that have engineering backgrounds seem to do really well in the classes, but the way the program is laid out, it's so that anyone with a diverse array of backgrounds can succeed in the courses, and finance is a cornerstone course for any MBA program, so I think the tools that they learn in there are really important, and they can be applied to the other courses. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that this is one reason why the weekend MBA program for professionals at IU Northwest seems to be pretty successful? You say it's been going on for at least a decade, longer, that it seems to work out well because people come out of the program after the 18 months of taking courses every other weekend and the taking advantage of the opportunities to, I guess what you could call it experiential learning, couldn't you? That will in turn go towards their degree, that they seem to come out better prepared for whatever career or in enhancement that they want in their own career?
That's the goal of an MBA, is for advancement and then also to, you know, enrich their learning. And the AACSB accreditation is in the top 3% of the business schools in the world and the top 5% of the business schools in the country. So with that accreditation, they know that they're going to get the best education that they can get out of an MBA program for their money, and then it's the most affordable weekend program in the region at around $37,000, and then it serves the Chicago area, so yeah. It's an affordable option, and the convenient hybrid model is, I think, good for the students.
Have you gotten any feedback from any of the former students, now MBA graduates?
Yeah, we always hear back from the MBA graduates, and I think the best feedback we get is that they encourage their colleagues and fellow students to go and pursue an MBA if they haven't yet, which is kind of the best endorsement, you know, we want to get.
Okay, Professor Payne, fill us in on some of the particulars now. We know that the admission period's open now for students that would like to sign up to take the classes on the weekends. Tell us what the procedure is, how you go about to be able to get signed up for the weekend MBA for Professionals program.
Sure. So one of the new things with our MBA program, and actually now our weeknight program, is that we have new and expanded GMAT and GRE waiver options. I think that is one of the things that is most intimidating for continuing education is to, you know, if you've been away from school for so long, to take an entrance exam, it might move students away from actually taking that first step to apply for the MBA. But some of the new waiver options include if you are a graduate with business core courses with a 3.2 GPA or higher, you can be eligible for a waiver for your GMAT. Also, we really look at professionals who have been working for at least 5 years in progressively responsible and preferably post-baccalaureate professional work. We also do consider U.S. military experience as a waiver if they've had 5 years. And then also any other graduate degrees or terminal degrees qualify you for a waiver. Besides the GMAT and the GRE, other required documents for admission include recommendation, obviously the application, a personal statement, and then a resume.
Now, all the ones have to do is, if you're interested, is to send the transcript on and let have a chance for you, Dr. Payne, to review this and your colleagues to take a look and see if somebody's ready for the course.
Yes, all you have to do is visit iun.edu/MBA for more information. And I did want to put a quick plug in, too, for our new weekend program that is beginning in Michigan City this spring in January of 2020. We're actually doing an off-site MBA program for those that are more in North Central, and we're drawing students in from Michigan as well. So there's another option for an off-site MBA. We come to your area, and they get the same exact experience as they would at this at our campus.
Well, it sounds like that would be a great advantage for somebody, as you say, that lives just across the state line in Michigan or off to the east someplace, maybe a little bit too far away from South Bend to take advantage of the courses there, but still close enough to Northwest Indiana to take advantage of them too, huh?
Absolutely. And we are now partnering, or we are now part of the it's called MSEP, and we do reciprocity for tuition. So if you're in the Michigan area, you could qualify to get tuition at 150% of in-state tuition.
So it's all there on the iun.edu website. Look up the information there, and we appreciate you spending time to talk with us about the program, and we hope that a number of people decide to take the plunge, take advantage of the professional and educational experience they may have, and go that next step further and get an MBA from IU Northwest. We've been talking with Professors Micah Pollack, Matthew Ludi, and Riccio Payne, and Professor Payne is the director of the program for MBA here at the IU Northwest. Cass County Councilwoman Stacy Donato is the newest member of the Indiana General Assembly. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports that Donato was elected on Monday night by a Republican Party precinct caucus.
Republican Randy Head served more than two terms in the state Senate before announcing his resignation earlier this year to become the chief deputy prosecutor in Pulaski County. That triggered a GOP precinct caucus to replace him, and after five ballots, Stacy Donato was its winner. Donato is a two-term councilwoman in Cass County and an accountant. Head backed her in the caucus. Donato becomes the fifth state lawmaker elected by a private caucus since last year's election, and 32 current members of the legislature, more than one out of every five, first joined the General Assembly via precinct caucuses. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
Some of the people on the front lines of the border crisis are volunteers who are donating their time to help migrants as they attempt to find a future in America. Several sisters from the Poor Handmaids of Jesus Christ, based out of Donaldson, Indiana, volunteered earlier this summer with an El Paso nonprofit called Annunciation House. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Brozier spoke to them about their experience.
The Poor Handmaids of Jesus Christ dedicate their lives to serving God and see helping the poor and powerless in their searches for justice as part of their mission. Sister Loretta Schlaper says she couldn't ignore what's happening on the U.S.-Mexico border, where political decisions and morality can seem at odds.
And I wanted to see how we could make a difference for the people who were there, in order to see what the issues really are.
Four of the sisters spent a few weeks volunteering in warehouses and shelters in El Paso, Texas, trying to provide some comfort to families who made the dangerous and exhausting journey to America. Sister Jolise May says the migrants they met all had the same motivation.
Their stories basically were, there's no future for us at home, and I'm doing it for my child. And that was the story, one after the other. This is for my child. There is no future. There is no education. There is no money.
One of Sister Edith Schneider's responsibility was accompanying families to bus stations, which was the beginning of another long journey for many of them. Sponsors buy the families tickets to different destinations in the U.S., where they will wait until their immigration court dates. She says many of the migrants traveled with no phones or money, just a small bag of belongings.
They are gentle, poor people escaping violence, and what they have to endure. Who of us would endure, whether it's trekking through Mexico or that 3 or 4 day bus trip?
Federal data shows U.S. Border Patrols have apprehended nearly 125,000 families in the El Paso sector so far this fiscal year, a more than 1,500% increase from the same period in 2018. The sisters say they try to tune out the negativity and debates that surround the border, but Schlaper says they couldn't ignore what they saw.
A lady and her 19-year-old daughter coming through, and they were like two gates away from freedom, you know, their chance to come in. When they said to her, actually said to her daughter, "What age are you?" And she honestly said, "I'm 19," where they snatched her away. And she was screaming, and the lady said she was screaming, because they said, You are to be independent.
Sister Connie Bach says they did what they could to comfort families in those heartbreaking situations. But they knew in the back of their minds, many of the migrants wouldn't be allowed to stay in the country long term.
It really is a crisis situation, and our country really should be looking at it just as much as, you know, hurricanes and tornadoes and all the things that affect our people. It's a life and death situation for a lot of people, and we've heard of the deaths already.
They're hopeful people will stop looking at the situation as a political one and see it for what they say it is, a humanitarian crisis. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
There is a facility here in Lake County that is Northwest Indiana's very first facility that offers what is referred to as fear-free practice. And to get that certification, folks at the Hanover Veterinary Hospital in Cedar Lake had to go through a lot of training. Let's find out more about it by talking with Laura Redendaugh of Hanover Veterinary Hospital. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thank you.
Well, first, explain, if you will, please, what fear-free practice certification is all about, and then tell us what, in turn, you all, the veterinarians, as well as the other staff members, had to go through to be able to be qualified for this.
Sure. So fear-free medicine is a newer initiative in the veterinary industry that recognizes that the things that we do during exams and visits to the veterinary hospital can cause fear, anxiety, and stress in a pet. And we know these kinds of anxieties, they can lead to long-term health effects and anxiety disorders in dogs and cats. The initiative is a commitment to not only taking care of their physical well-being, but also the emotional well-being of the pet while they're with the practice. And not just here in the practice during their exam, but everything that leads up to the exam, the trip over, the trip home from the veterinary hospital. We just recognized that there was a better way to do this for pets. So the practice certification followed the staff being certified, and certification was available for team members in veterinary hospitals starting in March of 2016. Mm-hmm. This whole initiative was started by Dr. Marty Becker, one of the known kind of as the American's veterinarian. Practice certification was available starting in April of 2018, and we achieved our practice certification in October of 2018. In order to achieve this type of practice certification, you have to meet 27 mandatory standards and then receive 1,000 out of a possible 2,000 of 28 more standards. And this can be everything from pheromone therapy during exams to what color of paint is on our walls, that these aren't stress triggers for animals. So it was a process in achieving this certification. We are certainly proud to be the first certified practice in Northwest Indiana.
Well, take us with a dog and a cat through the process when we bring our family pet in to have an exam of some sort or some procedure of some sort at the end. What do you see in the lobby and as they get further along into the facility, get into the exam rooms?
That fear-free visit starts in the waiting room. We use pheromone therapy, and these are dog and cat appeasing pheromones used in diffusers and sprays that humans don't smell it, but it can bring the level of a dog's anxiety down. And then as they move through their exam, there are many portions of that exam that maybe you don't even notice that are going on behind the scenes, such as touch gradient and considerate approach of the animal, which means you don't just rush right up and in a really loud voice and talk to that animal right away, to gentle restraint techniques. You use the least amount of restraint to get done what you need to. We have pheromone therapy going in the exam rooms. And then one of the most, I think, obvious parts of a fear-free exam is going to be in the treat ladder. So the goal is to create a positive experience for the pet while they're here because animals build on their experiences. So if we create negative experience after negative experience, each visit will escalate with a pet, and that's putting both the animal and the staff at risk in working with them. So we use treat ladders. You start with something that's sort of low reward, maybe like a crunchy dog biscuit, and then you move through things like semi-soft treats and everything up to whipped cream cups and ice cream. And, we get really creative in what kind of treats we bring in. This month is National Ice Cream Awareness Month or something along those lines, so we're doing ice cream with all of our appointments on Fridays for dogs.
That's interesting.
And cats. So that's the more obvious part of the exam. But keeping the noise level down, doing calming music throughout the hospital and through those visits for them, all of those things combined together can bring down, you know, that stress for that animal while they're with us.
Okay. Let's go through the choice of pet. Let's say you bring a dog in. What special things do you intend to do as part of this procedure that will help make the experience not only better for the dog, but also for the pet owner and for the staff members?
For the pet owner, one of the barriers to bringing your animal to the veterinary hospital is that they're scared. You don't want to see your pet get a vaccine. You don't want to see them struggle during a nail trim. And it's traumatic to you as the pet owner because we love them so much and we don't want to see them in these highly anxious states. So if we can bring down the pet stress level, that will automatically carry over. It makes it more pleasant for the pet owner to bring it. They're not as anxious about bringing their pet to the vet hospital if they know that those pets are going to be treated like family. You know, that every consideration is going to be taken to try to ease their fear of the vet visit. So that's on kind of on the client side of thing, as well as communicating with them things that they can do to bring their pet in the least stressful way possible. And that mm-hmm. might be through giving calming supplements at home or medications if that's what's needed, to playing some calming music on the way over, using pheromone therapy in their car, both on the trip over and the trip home, and that can start that visit off a little bit better.
How about for kitty cats?
For cats, there's a pheromone called Feel-Away, and it works very well in cats. But bringing them in a carrier and then not having them wait in the waiting room where they might experience loud noises like dogs barking or phones ringing or things like this. Cats are very sensitive to noise. So our practice has a separate exam room that's kind of off of the main traffic of the hospital, and it is set up to, it's all about cats in there. We have not only pheromone, but we use textures that are pleasing to cats, like fluffy blankets and things like that. They have a litter box provided for them. They have a scratching post. We have cat nip, if that's what's needed for them,
yeah.
To bring that down, because cats in particular, not only can they be really dangerous when they're fearful, because they have usually more weapons than you have hands to control them during that visit, they tend to escalate quicker than mm-hmm. dogs do when you are stressing them.
Now, what seems to be the reaction, not only from the clients, the pets, but for the pet owners as well, too, to all of these procedures that you are now introducing, basically, into Northwest Indiana in the fear-free practice?
Well, we've had some great feedback. It's reflected in our reviews and our testimonials from appointments where now people are talking about how calm their pet was during the appointment and how much they appreciated the extra time that we took to make sure their pet was comfortable with us and had a positive experience while they were here. We've had really good feedback. Our clients are really supportive. We're a well-established hospital in the area. This hospital's actually been in this area for 30 years. So mm-hmm. our client base has been able to move through this process with us. They've been with, you know, and yeah, great feedback from the clients. And the pets are, now that we're more than a year into it, we're starting to see repeated fear-free visits for pets, and we can tell the difference from prior to starting, you know, using some of these techniques to now where we can finally get, say, a nail trim done without, you know, three people to restrain. And we definitely see these animals coming in a lot happier and leaving a lot happier. Our goal is always to make the visit as pleasant as mm-hmm. possible, and we definitely are seeing pets react to that when they're having follow-up visits where they're not coming in as stressed.
Now, do you know if there are any other veterinary hospitals here in the region that are interested in this, to go through the certification process and to become certified as well?
I do think that this is something that probably a lot of veterinary hospitals are going to be going to. You know, I think that all of us in the veterinary industry, you know, are in it for the love of the animal. So anytime something comes up that gives us better tools to work with them and create these better experiences for them, I think everybody's probably going to get on board eventually. I know there are other veterinary hospitals in the area that have fear-free certified staff, but mm-hmm. so far as yet, we are the only practice certified hospital. So we'll see.
Laura, thank you very much for the info, and congratulations for everybody there at the Hanover Veterinary Hospital in Cedar Lake of going through the process and being able to help make things better for not only the pets, the clients of your practice, but also for the owners of the pets as well, too. Thank you for the information.
Thank you so much for your time today.
Laura Redendaw is with the Hanover Veterinary Hospital in Cedar Lake.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for being with us. Tomorrow on the program, we will talk with Ann Massey, who is with the Northwest Indiana Food Council, about Farm Hop 2019. And we also will talk with Suzanne Stannis with the Indiana Landmarks about an interesting online opportunity to look at some really interesting types of homes. It's all coming up.